I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President-elect Barack Obama this morning named his nominees for a national security team, Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Janet Napolitano as Homeland Security Chief, Susan Rice for Ambassador to the UN among them. Brian Bender is covering the story for the Boston Globe. And Brian, Barack Obama spoke as the landscape appears to be changing under his feet. Nuclear-armed India and Pakistan suddenly on the front burner after India blamed Pakistan for last week's attacks in Mumbai. Did Obama say anything about that?
Well, I think he was very careful, and his comments were very measured. He was asked several times whether he thought India had the right to respond in Pakistan to attack some of these groups that are allegedly involved in these attacks. He held his cards very close to his chest. Obviously, he's very concerned about keeping a lid on things there. India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons, and, you know, I think his comments just illustrate that this is going to be a very, very difficult, thorny, diplomatic headache for him once he takes office, is dealing with the terrorism issue, but dealing with it in a way where India and Pakistan stay at the table with each other and things don't get out of hand.
Well, this is further interesting because he, of course, introduced his choice for Secretary of State, and that's Hillary Clinton. And he and Clinton disagreed during the campaign on how to handle rogue leaders and nations, specifically whether or not the U.S. should enter Pakistan.
Right. And I think, as President-elect Obama pointed out, some of those differences perhaps were magnified during the campaign. I mean, Obama was very clear that he supported going after terrorist targets if there was actionable intelligence, obviously working with the Pakistani government if at all possible. So I'm not one of those who believes that their point of view on this is all that different. Clearly, during the campaign, Senator Clinton jumped on that issue, saying that he was reckless, that he was going to go invade Pakistan. I'm not sure that's exactly what he was saying.
And what did Hillary Clinton have to say today?
I think it's very interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about her being a rival of his and him bringing her into his cabinet, much as Abraham Lincoln brought some of his political rivals into his cabinet. But I also think that there is a sort of a coming together, if you will, of the Clinton legacy and what will be the Obama legacy. Because Hillary Clinton, quite frankly, is going to have to deal with some issues that were left undone when her husband was president, Middle East peace, dealing with international terrorism, that sort of thing. And in some ways, the fortunes of President Obama will be very much linked with not just Hillary Clinton's legacy, but you could also argue her husband's legacy.
And you could add to the list of issues that she might have to address now the disputed region of Kashmir between Pakistan and India. We understand Clinton said, speaking about the attacks in Mumbai, that America cannot solve these crises without the world, and the world cannot solve them without America. It seemed like a different tone from the Bush administration, sort of, you're for us or against us, you know, go it alone. Did you hear some of that?
Absolutely. I think the tone of President-elect Obama's remarks, as well as some of the remarks of his team, illustrates that he believes and they believe that America's power includes lots of different things. It's not just military power or military might. Obama said it several times. Vice President-elect Biden made reference to it, and I think it's a very different approach than what we've seen in recent years, and that is that if America is going to achieve its goals, it's going to have to use its military might at times, but it's the power of America's ideals, American diplomacy, all those other elements of national power, as they call them, and I think there's going to be a much bigger emphasis on that in the coming years. And interestingly, the choice of Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, you know, some people have been surprised that he would keep on President Bush's last defense secretary. But when it comes to furthering American interests using things beyond military might, it's actually been Gates who has been talking about that for 2 years, that basically the State Department needs more resources. And coming from a Secretary of Defense who runs the Pentagon, that's a very unique perspective.
The idea of getting at the root of terrorism through things like poverty and failed nations. But did Obama say anything about speculation today that Bill Clinton might be named special envoy to Kashmir?
Obama did not mention that President Clinton would have a role in mediating between India and Pakistan, but there have been some rumors that that could be an area where the former president could be of assistance. Clearly, Kashmir is the main thorny issue between India and Pakistan. And until that problem is solved, really all the other problems are never going to be addressed.
Brian Bender, reporter for the Boston Globe in Washington, D.C. Brian, thanks so much.
Sure.
Expect fallout, expect foreclosures, expect horror stories. That was the warning from a California mortgage lender to bank regulators back in January 2006. A new Associated Press investigation shows the Bush administration turned a blind eye to warnings like that one dating back to 2005. Well, others were also sounding alarms, including people who worked on Wall Street and were making money by betting that the subprime market would fail. Michael Lewis writes about the current crisis in his new article, After the Fall, in Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. And you may remember Michael first exposed the excesses on Wall Street with his 1990 book, Liar's Poker. So why did it take nearly 20 years for the downfall he predicted, the one we're experiencing now, to happen? Michael Lewis joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us your story, first of all. Take us back. Who were you when you were hired on Wall Street at Salomon Brothers? Because you write in Liar's Poker, you were incredulous that you were even hired.
Yes. I'd just gotten out of graduate school. I didn't know anything about money. I didn't manage money. I didn't have my own money to manage. I'd never had an accounting course. But Wall Street, as it has been until very recently, sucked in lots of people who just kind of had good grades. I have kind of lucked into a job at Salomon Brothers. But to my surprise, very pleasant surprise, within a year I was making six figures, and after 2 years was making $250,000 and was on a trajectory to make a lot more than that. It was bewildering to me that my value in the world had been transformed to the extent it was by this machine known as Wall Street.
Well, not just yours. You write that sooner rather than later, you assumed that thousands of young people like you who had no business experience and no business making huge bets with other people's money would be expelled from finance. But instead...
Yes, I thought that this was kind of a joke because I could not connect what they were paying me to what I was doing. I mean, it didn't make any sense. What I was doing was not obviously of any value, and yet I was getting all this money. I just assumed that this was unsustainable. And so when I left and wrote Liar's Poker, I was widely applauded for walking away from all the money to go do what I wanted to do. But it wasn't as hard as all that because I just assumed the money would stop. I thought I was writing from the end of a period that had been the most absurd and obscene sort of money grab in the history of the universe.
And instead it went on for another 20 years.
Instead, it went on for another 20 years.
And got more obscene. Well, your article centers around a group of people who took their cues from someone named Steve Eisman. Now, in 1991, he was also a 30-something who, as he tells you later, you know, got his job at Oppenheimer through his parents. He says, not pretty, but that's what happened. He also didn't know what he was doing. Now, let's just lay this out. Suddenly, there's a subprime mortgage company which goes public. And as you write, no one bothers to question, gee, you know, these are risky mortgages. Why do we want to invest in them? Instead, you write about Oppenheimer executives who are running around looking for someone who knows about mortgages to handle this new subprime account, and they choose Steve Eisman.
As Steve Eisman said, I was a lawyer who didn't know anything. I just arrived, and no one else wanted to cover this company, and I was in the department that covered companies, so this became my first call. And his job was to analyze this company and see if it made any sense to invest in it. So he looked into it, and he said, my God, this thing is a house of cards. It's going to collapse. And he put sell. Back then, analysts really didn't put sell recommendations on things. Their job was in part kind of boosterish. If they really had reservations, they just didn't say anything.
And people actually took him to task. They said, what are you talking about, sell? You're not supposed to say that.
He was brutally honest about what he saw. And it turned out this company that he said sell was in bankruptcy within 6 months.
Well, and let's collapse the storyline here for time, because Steve ultimately decides, okay, if people want to trade this, crappy stuff, then I'm going to be part of betting on it failing. Now, we've used a metaphor to describe securitization. That's the bundling of loans. As you would bundle asparagus, then they're sliced and the slice is sold. If someone gets the tips of the asparagus, that's good. The further down, less so, right?
That's correct. But you got to imagine that because these asparagus are all subprime mortgages, they're already kind of half rotted from the bottom up. So they're asparagus that any sane person would look at and say, the only thing that may be salvageable here is the tips.
But then Wall Street started selling sort of insurance on this lousy asparagus, but it's not really insurance because it's not regulated. It's more like a bet that, like a Las Vegas bet, whether or not they'll fail.
Yes, but since asparagus can't fail, we've got to keep our metaphor clean. It's a bet that the asparagus will be edible, that the tips will be edible. And in fact, they had arisen from about 2004 on Wall Street, a giant sort of a casino of side bets on subprime mortgages. They had nothing to do with lending money to anybody. They were just bets on whether people would repay their mortgages. And say $2 trillion in loans, roughly, subprime mortgage loans were made between 2004 and 2006. Multiples of that, many trillions of dollars of bets were made on whether those mortgages would pay off. So much more was at stake in subprime mortgages than just whether the mortgages would be paid.
So Steve Eisman, who's looking critically at all of this, sees what's going on. He's looking at the housing market. He sees historically the ratio of median home prices to income is 3-1. Now it's 4-1. In some cities, 10-1. He's seeing, hey, people can't afford this. So he gets in the business of just buying those bets, of making money off the failures?
He gets in the business very specifically of finding pools of subprime mortgages, say in South Florida or the Inland Empire in California, places where the lending was especially obscene, identifying the pool of subprime mortgages that is the worst, the crappiest mortgages, calling up Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank and saying, okay, I want to lay a bet against that one. But to get to this point took him years. When he finally gets in the business of running money at his own hedge fund, it took him the better part of 18 months to figure out what Wall Street had done. He was actually kind of naive about it when he walked in. He couldn't believe that they had erected this house of cards. And he was shocked to find that there was this casino of side bets going on. But when he saw it, he thought, well, that's the best way to express the view I have. And the view I have is this lending should not be going on. It is a bubble. It will collapse. I want to take the other side of it.
Well, and he also had these anecdotal experiences. One was with his South American housekeeper and former Jamaican nanny, who called him one day to say, as he says, a lovely woman from Jamaica, called him one day and said that she and her sister now owned 5 townhouses in Queens. Tell us about that.
Yes, he said, how did you get into that situation? And she says, well, they kind of gave us the money to buy one, and it went up. And so we had profits in that one, and so we went and bought another one. One thing led to another. No one ever asked for their credit score or asked them to put money down. And they saw it as a business. His former Jamaican baby nurse had gone into the real estate speculation business. And this is what, one way or another, everyone did, even people who were living in their homes in South Florida and the Inland Empire in California. They'd buy a house, no money down, for $750,000. It would go up in value to $1 million. They'd go back to the bank and refinance, take out $250,000 that they could then spend. Houses were being used as ATMs in a way. He saw this, and he knew it was unsustainable, and it was just a question of how to express that view.
We've been speaking with Michael Lewis, author of the article in Condé Nast Portfolio, After the Fall, Greed, Stupidity, and Really Bad Luck, How Wall Street Did Itself In. And Michael, let's continue your story. We were talking about Steve Eisman, an investor who looked at what was happening with subprime mortgages and predicted they would fail and bring the market down with them. He tried to sound the warning through betting against those bad investments. He also tried to directly tell rating agencies these are the agencies that are supposed to judge how well companies are doing, agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's. Tell us about that.
Well, he had 2 encounters with the rating agencies that he couldn't get out of his head. First was, he saw that this whole game was premised on house prices going up, and that were trillions of dollars at stake. He couldn't help but ask, what happens if they don't go up? So he called Standard & Poor's, one of the leading rating agencies, and said, in your model, says, what happens if house prices go down? And the guy on the other end of the phone said, well, actually, the computer doesn't let me enter a negative number. We haven't even thought of that, basically. And then we get on conference calls, and because they were taking negative views, Eisman wasn't allowed really usually to ask questions. He would just sit and listen to the conference calls. But the CEO of Moody's, Eisman pestered him, said, well, come on by my office and let's talk. And Eisman and his colleagues went down to see the CEO of Moody's, and they said, these things are going to go bad. And the man from Moody's was, he thought, completely straight with him, said, no, we think all this is absolutely fine, and it's all going to hold up fine. And they turned to him and said, sir, I'm sorry to put it this way, but you're delusional.
This is what Eisman said to Moody's, to the
Eisman's
Raider.
Colleague actually said, but he said it in the most innocent sort of way. He says, God, I feel so sorry for you that you think that, because it's what's about to happen to you is so awful. And it's happening now, and they were right.
Well, and Eisman has another sort of light bulb going off moment when he discovered that, you know, here he is making all these bets against investments and winning, and he finally understood that the banks wanted him to do that.
Well, this is where it gets complicated and strange, because he didn't understand why there was such an appetite at, say, Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank for him to call up and bet against the absolute worst subprime mortgages. He couldn't figure out why they'd want to be on the other side of that bet at first. And then he was in Las Vegas at a trade association meeting. He was seated next to a man who was an investor in subprime mortgages. He knew what the guy owned. And this is kind of late in the game. This was in 2007. And he says, you know, I'm sorry that you're in this situation, Eisman said to him. And the guy said, why? He says, well, you know, it's all going to go bad. You're going to have big losses. And the guy says, no, I don't actually own these things. What he invested in was called CDOs. He says, you're a CDO investor. He says, no. I just take a fee from the fund. In the end, the people who hire me to do this, if it goes down, they're the ones who are going to lose. Eisman said, well, that's outrageous. You're in charge of vetting subprime mortgages as an investment. These people hire you to do that, and you don't have any risk, so you don't care. And the guy said, kind of laughed about it. And Eisman said, well, you must hate me, because my job is shorting these things, is betting against them. And the guy said, no, I love guys like you. Without you, I don't have anything to buy. It was then Eisman realized that he was actually had become part of this machine, that what when he went and laid the side bet off with Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank or Goldman Sachs took the side bet and packaged it into essentially another security, another thing that looked like a bond, like a subprime mortgage bond.
More asparagus.
More asparagus that he was creating by betting against it. He was creating synthetic asparagus. He paid to Deutsche Bank or Goldman Sachs sort of the equivalent of a subprime mortgage interest rate. And so he was sort of like a fake subprime mortgage borrower when he was betting against this. And he didn't realize that. So now he knew that not only were there bonds out there that were backed by subprime mortgages, there were bonds out there that were backed by his bets.
Against
the subprime mortgages. And he said, oh, my God.
Well, and here you are, sitting on the sidelines, watching all of this. And as you write, at this point, it's been a couple of decades after your book, Liar's Poker, and you just gave up. You just felt there was no scandal, no reversal that could sink the system. But then, as we know, it starts sinking big time. You write about a woman, Meredith Whitney, at Oppenheimer, who is the one who burst the bubble, who says, no, this is all overrated. This is going to explode. But back to Eisman. How does he feel now about being such a part of it? As he said, it was like feeding the monster. He started out wanting to sort of send the signal that he didn't think anything was valuable, but he made a lot of money along the way, and he became a critical part of the system.
Well, yes. He was doing what he was supposed to be doing. He was doing what if everybody had done, we wouldn't have had the problems. He was being intelligent, kind of prudent with the money he managed. You know, he said, look, we fed the monster until it blew up. He did, in fact, sound alarms everywhere. He did it in a much more powerful way than if he'd gone to the Wall Street Journal. He would get on conference calls with investors and say, this is going to be a disaster if it continues. He did something very unusual for a hedge fund investor. He had a conference call with the people who put money into his fund. And it's normally, you know, it was a dozen people or something. And he opened it up to all of Wall Street. And by then, there were a number of people on Wall Street who knew Steve Eisman knew something they did not. And there were 500 people who listened in, and then another 500 people who came in and listened to the tape afterwards. And on this, he just ripped the whole system and explained why it was going to be a total disaster, and at the end of it, we're going to be looking at something like a depression. And people laughed at him. They didn't believe him. So I think no matter what he had done publicly, it would have done no good. It would have changed nothing. It would have just made him look ridiculous.
And Michael, he was, making these bets, as you said, partly as a way of signaling how he felt about the market. But did he make money, or did he also lose in the last few weeks?
Well, no, he's rich.
Yeah.
You can assume he's rich. It's funny, because for someone who believed what he believed and saw what he saw, the big money was made in 2007. Right now, it's very hard for someone like him to be making money. That game that he played is over. The subprime mortgage market has collapsed. The next game is, and what he's entered into, is sifting through this wreckage and finding the value, finding the pools of loans that actually will pay off. So that's what he's engaged in now.
Michael Lewis wrote about the financial crisis on Wall Street for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. He's also editor of the new book, Panic, the Story of Modern Financial Insanity. Michael, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, $1 trillion for a fighter jet? Are we paying too much and getting too little for the U.S. weapon systems? Also, a doctor's prescription for healthcare reform. Is it time to save money by rationing some care? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, new music from Sixpence None the Richer. After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's World AIDS Day. In Scotland, a youth group is giving out condoms. Bulgaria has a new slogan, every day is anti-AIDS. Well, every day, nearly 6,000 people die from AIDS. 7,000 are infected with the HIV virus, adding to the estimated 33 million people who live with HIV/AIDS. The vast majority are in developing countries, where only a third get the antiretroviral treatment they need. That's particularly ironic in India. As Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen points out in his introduction to a new book, no country has done more than India to lower the cost of AIDS drugs, but most infected people in India can't afford them. And while much about AIDS in India sounds familiar, much is unique. For instance, there are the Devadasis, women pledged as impoverished children to be in the service of a Hindu goddess. But in modern times, that means to grow up to be a prostitute. The book is called AIDS Sutra, Untold Stories from India. Nigar Akafi is the editor. She joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Nalini Jones, an author and adjunct writing professor at Columbia and Fairfield Universities. She's also written an essay in the book and joins us from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Nalini, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And I want to start with you because your essay is entitled Love in the Time of Positives. It's a play on love in the time of cholera. What did you mean by that?
I think I was astonished when I got to Bangalore and I began interviewing people. I thought I would encounter almost entirely stories of heartbreak, and I did. But I also found astonishing stories of strength and love, and one of them is about this remarkable couple who met after they had both sort of come to terms with being HIV positive and both had become counselors, and they fell in love and got married.
Well, and that happens elsewhere, but what seems uniquely Indian is that the woman, Jayanthi's parents, didn't want her to marry Besavaraj because the woman had had Ayurvedic treatment, and parents believed that she'd been cured. She hadn't been cured. But they had a fear of her being with a positive man, even though she herself was positive.
It's a terrible, terrible story about how much parents love their children, too. I think these parents simply couldn't accept that their child was beyond their help. They took all the money they had, and they spent it all on treatment that they hoped would heal her. And once the treatment was completed, they simply trusted she had been healed, and they were no longer willing for her to consider entering into a marriage with anyone who was positive. They wanted to find a nice negative man for her. So the issue of arranged marriage absolutely became a part of their story.
Well, Nagara, arranged marriages are a part of many of the stories that we hear. We hear about families keeping a son's positive diagnosis a secret from a wife in an arranged marriage. We hear things that, you know, may be duplicated in other cultures in different ways, but what do you see that's uniquely Indian with the struggle with HIV/AIDS?
Well, I'd say that one of the biggest challenges we have in India is just the stigma, apathy, and the sense that India's morality will protect it from HIV. And in a country where there are almost 3 million infections, the largest in Asia and the third largest in the world, we know this is simply not the truth.
Well, we also read about, it seems, subsets of groups that other countries have. For instance, India has gay communities, but also MSMs, men who sleep with men. And as I said, not unlike men in the U.S. who don't think they are gay, but sleep with men. But there also seem to be more formalized subsets of groups affected by AIDS. Salman Rushdie writes about the Hijras, if I said that correctly?
Yeah, Hijras, yes.
Who are they? Do they have a basis in religious beliefs?
They do. The Hijras are a fascinating, incredible group in India. They're basically India's transgender community who have a unique role in Hinduism. You see them participating in marriage ceremonies, in births of children, but then also sometimes they become extortioners of money, taking bribes, threatening to put a spell or to cast evil on a family if they don't pay up. So they have a very unique role in India, but they also are confronting a prevalence of around 20%.
Of infection?
Of HIV, yes.
Are they outcasts, though, in some ways, as well as, spiritual parts of spiritual ceremonies?
They are definitely outcasts. They're ostracized, they're teased, they're taunted. But then at the same time, they have this interesting level of respect. Part of why you see such a high prevalence amongst Hijras or amongst subsets of sex workers is because they are pushed underground, because they're so kind of stigmatized and marginalized that efforts to reach them become incredibly difficult. And then on top of all this, then there's legislation that makes sodomy in India illegal.
Even though, you have authors who follow men as they go to parks and meet with other men, go home to their wives afterwards, it seems as if it's quite visible.
It's definitely visible. There's no denying that there are same-sex couples, and I think just the legislation is not keeping up with the times.
It's interesting, Nalini, because in your essay you write about this, the unbelievable taboo against discussing sex, and I made a note in the book, that this is the country that brought us the Kama Sutra. So what's the disconnect? What is that?
That has always intrigued me. For me, what was so intriguing is the people that I was talking to were, in fact, married people. Most of the time, the sex that we were talking about was between, men and women. In one case, it was between a man and a sex worker that he encountered in a lodge. And that was very embarrassing to him to have that conversation with me. But even the conversations about men and women having sex within marriage was something that was sort of an uncomfortable conversation.
And Nagar, Nalini mentioned sex workers. Tell us more about the Devadasis. These are female sex workers who are dedicated as children by their families to following sort of this Hindu goddess, but it certainly seems, again, like a terrible life of a sex worker.
Yeah, so this is an ancient tradition that basically takes place in northern Karnataka. And one daughter from each family is dedicated to this goddess, Yalama, and becomes a courtesan or the equivalent of a temple prostitute. What's crazy is that this community is now facing an HIV rate of almost 30%. And each year, estimates range between 1,000 to 10,000 women are dedicated into this practice still.
What do they say of it?
They almost feel like it's just fate. There isn't really a choice in the matter. And you'll see in William Dalrymple's piece, he talks to kind of a three generation of women who have all come into this trade, and how, a mother who was once forcibly put into the Devadasi system then decides to put her own daughter into it, and that it just is kind of this is the way it goes.
And when she says that her two daughters, in fact, die these horrible deaths, she doesn't say it, but it's obviously AIDS.
Yes. And at the end of the story, she doesn't reveal it herself, but someone else there reveals that she, too, is HIV positive.
And can't even say it and is still taking in men.
Yes.
Yeah. Aman Sethi writes about truck drivers in India. And Amartya Sen, I mentioned the economist who wrote the introduction, he actually writes that the country's decision to put money into roads and trucking instead of trains has increased the epidemic.
This is Nalini speaking, but anecdotally that makes sense to me. Of the half dozen women I spoke to who contracted HIV from their husbands, many of them had truck drivers for husbands. And this has been the way that they've understood AIDS as something that comes from husbands and something that comes from the roads.
And Nagar, we just want to touch on one last astonishing essay. Jaspreet Singh went to a care home for children with AIDS and reminds us that sex education was outlawed in some Indian states, that children are kicked out of school for being positive, and it's gotten to the point where they are assembled together in these homes.
Yes, the home that he visited is one of the best run. It's almost like a fantastic boarding school of sorts where the kids have all sorts of facilities. But at the same time, you do notice that all of these children have been abandoned by their families. There was a boy I had met several years ago who his parents both died of HIV, and his grandparents actually thought that it was the boy's fault, that he had somehow cursed them. So they left him outside an NGO in Manipur with a sign that said, "He's a curse, we don't want him." And he was on the verge of death when someone brought him down to the care home.
So given these stories, putting them together like this with the sutra, the thread that runs through all of them of AIDS, what do you hope to happen because of it, Nagar?
Well, I hope it opens our eyes to the fact that every country, every society has marginalized communities. And I think, as Amartya Sen really said best, that half understanding is worse than ignorance. So before we cast judgment, we should maybe dig a little deeper and really understand what is it that's causing this.
And Nalini, what do you hope to bring to light with your essay?
I actually was most pleased with what the essay brought to light for me. I am furious still about the husband who, he and his wife were tested for AIDS. The results came back. The wife didn't know how to read them properly, but she saw that they had different results. He said it was because I'm a man and you're a woman, when in fact, of course, it was because he was positive and she was negative. If he had taken any kind of precautions at all, they could at least have protected the child that was unborn at that time. But running through all of that, I was so impressed by how these villagers were coping with this extraordinary problem. I went to two or three different community meetings. They were full of women and children. Children were doing their schoolwork in the back. The women were all talking about how they could start savings accounts for their HIV-positive kids, how they might get train discounted fares. I find my best hopes in that, in their own power, in their own community activism.
That's author Nalini Jones. Her essay in the book AIDS Sutra is entitled Love in the Time of Positives. And Nagar Agafi edited the book. Again, it's called AIDS Sutra, Untold Stories from India. Nagar and Nalini, thanks to you both for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, staying with India, this note. The 2-year-old found next to his parents' bodies at the Chabad Jewish Center after last week's attacks in Mumbai is bound for Israel today, accompanied by the Indian nanny who rescued him. Rabbi Gabriel Noah Holtzberg and his wife Rivka were brutally murdered by gunmen in the Lubavitch Center and are in the thoughts of people like Emily Blatt of New Hampshire. Now, Emily, you're one of thousands who passed through this center. How'd you happen upon it?
Well, I was visiting some dear friends in Delhi for a few weeks, and I took a trip for a few days on my own to Mumbai just to see the city. And when I realized that I was going to be there during Passover, I thought it would be fun to see if I could find a Seder to go to. So I Googled Chabad House Mumbai Seder and found it in about 60 seconds.
And what was it like?
Oh, it was great. There are about 30 to 40 people there, very casual, very informal. I sat with a flight crew from El Al. There are also some American college students who were on a project in Jaipur, and they'd come specifically for the Seder. There were some people traveling from Mexico, from Australia. There was an Indian family that lived in Mumbai. It was kind of a random assortment.
Yeah.
And then we had a Seder.
And did you meet the rabbi and his wife?
Yes, I did.
What were they like?
They were very sweet. Very welcoming. The rabbi's father was visiting from New York, and it was very clear that they were thrilled to be together for Passover.
And your thoughts as you watched the center attacked, having, you know, been there a couple years ago?
Oh, it's just horrible. Just horrible. Horrifying. Very sad.
Yeah.
Nobody deserves to be attacked like that. Nobody. And these people certainly didn't.
Emily Blatt of New Hampshire with thoughts on the attacks on the Chabad Jewish Center in Mumbai. The surviving child of the center's founding rabbi and his wife will live in Israel with his grandparents and his Indian nanny. Back in a minute. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Bye.
Welcome back. And it's back. Kiss Me from Sixpence None the Richer. It was the You Can't Go Anywhere Without Hearing It song of 1999. Remember when it was featured in the film She's All That and then parodied in Not Another Teen Movie? Well, Sixpence None the Richer parted ways a few years after that hit, but they've reunited, or been resurrected, we could say, because they are, after all, a Christian rock band. They're soon going to head back into the studio to produce a new CD for next year, but meanwhile...
Angels we have heard on high, singing sweetly through the night.
That's the opening song on The Dawn of Grace, a collection of Christmas songs from Sixpence None the Richer. And Lee Nash, the voice of Sixpence, joins us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Along with another great mainstay of the group, Matt Slocum. Matt, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And this would seem a natural for you two, because Lee, do I understand that you both met in a Christian retreat camp in Texas?
Yeah, we did. We went to the same church for a while, and that's where we first met. So this is nice.
Well, what does it mean to you to be a Christian rock band? Because it's not as if Kiss Me was talking about, we are Christians, so kiss me. You know, it's not there in the lyrics. What does that mean to you, Matt?
Well, I think originally when we got together and met in church, we were both interested in performing and singing and playing and writing music, and we wanted to express our faith. And at the time, that seemed like the best way to do it was to enter into the Christian music business. But I think as we went on, we found that there were some pitfalls within that. There were some limits creatively and artistically, and I think we sort of realized we wanted to sort of appeal to a broader audience.
Right. But here you are back with Christmas music, a collection of mostly traditional songs. But Matt, you wrote an original tune for the CD, The Last Christmas. Let's listen to that.
I feel your heart beating inside my own skin, and I think of Mary in Bethlehem. When darkness was shattered, the dawn of God's grace, and the journey began to the first Easter day. On this last Christmas, the last Christmas, the last Christmas, the very last Christmas, the last.
So pretty. And Matt, how do you go about writing a new Christmas song? I mean, a lot has been said in Christmas songs. Like, what did you feel you were saying here that maybe hadn't been said?
My wife was pregnant during the time we were making this record, and we had all this anticipation for the advent of our daughter, and it just sort of naturally led into this song, like identifying with the coming of Christ, all the changes that have to be made, all the preparation, and when it does happen and it does come, it just changes everything. So that was kind of the inspiration.
Right. Well, Lee, you also, as you said, take on classic Christmas songs that people have in their head in a certain way. And one of them that you do in a slightly different way is Silent Night. Let's just listen for a second. Now, those other lyrics, that second line there, that's Dan Hasseltine from another Christian band, Jars of Clay. You're obviously friends. What is he saying?
Well, part of it, he's saying, underneath these lights that glow, I can tell that you've been crying.
I think one of his close friends was in the midst of a separation, and he was experiencing Christmas music through this very sort of, it was invoking all this sadness in him, and he wanted to kind of create this subplot to Silent Night, how that night would affect someone who was feeling sad as opposed to happy.
So,
I'm a person that in the last 2 years have come out of a 10-year marriage, and hearing that lyric set to that music, because I've seen firsthand the last two Christmases what that feels like, experiencing the holidays without that person. it's awfully sad, but it's true, you know, and I think it's amazing that he kind of brought those two things together. It's so random, but it's so beautiful.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, if it's why maybe you tackled, now, Silent Night is one thing, but there are many of us who feel that the truly iconic Christmas song is Joni Mitchell's River.
Yeah.
Let's listen.
I'm so hard to handle. I'm selfish and I'm sad. Now I've gone and lost the best baby that I ever had. And I wish I had a river I could skate away on. Oh, I wish I had a river so long. I would teach my feet to fly. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby say goodbye.
Now, Lee, one critic said your version of Mitchell's somewhat dark already river was maybe almost a bridge too far for the usually chipper Nash. But did you need that song? I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, I think anybody in the music industry, she at one point, I think in the first verse, she says, "I'm going to make a lot of money and quit this crazy scene." I think everybody feels that way sometimes. The first bit of money that I'm going to get out really, really fast, just because it's so scary. And then that on top of, I'm a single mother now and came out of this really long relationship. It's definitely been an uphill climb the last 2 years. And so that song, yeah, kind of embodied everything I've been going through.
Well, it's also, too, about, I mean, the idea that people might hear Kiss Me, Matt, and think, oh, what a chipper little group. But life, faith, you know, they're hard sometimes. As you go forward, you've got a new CD you're doing. You're going back out on the road with Jars of Clay. But is this an older, wiser, maybe also seeing some of the darker things, Sixpence?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Kiss Me is definitely a historical moment for the band and will always define the band, but I think we're just hoping that we can be allowed by the people that follow our music to express different sides of ourselves and keep doing that for a long time to come.
That's Matt Slocum, one of the two members of Sixpence, None the Richer, with us. The other's Lee Nash. Their new CD is The Dawn of Grace, a collection of traditional and original Christmas songs. More on the group. Their name comes from a passage in a C.S. Lewis novel. You can go to our website to read more at here-now.org. And Lee, we should mention you also composed one of the original songs on the new CD. It's called Christmas for Two.
Yes.
And we'll go out on that.
Okay.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
They can have their trimmed up trees, dressing up on Christmas Eve. There's so many other things we'd rather do, like making angels in the snow, playing records soft and low, bundle up and watch the fire grow.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
We don't need nothing new.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Yeah, I'd rather have Christmas with you.
PRI, Public Radio International.